Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guests today are Anatole Levin and John Hulsman. Anatole Levin is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and is the author of America, Right or Wrong, An Anatomy of American Nationalism. He writes regularly for the Financial Times and the LA Times. John Hulsman is a former senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as a contributing editor to the National Interest. He is a scholar in residence this year at the German Council on Foreign Relations in Berlin. Levin and Hulsman have just written Ethical Realism, and we're here with them to talk about their new book. Welcome to Berkeley, gentlemen.
Pleasure to be here.
How did you come to write this book?
I think it's a very interesting story that in Washington there's a tradition of being a gunslinger and shooting it out if you do TV, as we both do. And so Anatole was seen as a man of the left, I was seen as a man of the right, and they brought us to the Middle East Institute to violently disagree, hopefully throw a chair would be more helpful at each other. And very early on, when Anatole, I believe, was talking, I said to myself, or out loud, good God, I agree with what he's saying. Mm-hmm. And this started a long-term discussion and collaboration where we realized that we had a common sense of impatience with the sameness of what neoconservatives in the Republican Party and liberal hawks in the Democratic Party were saying about the future of the United States, which is, in effect, it's a unipolar world. The United States can tell people what to do, and in fact ought to tell people what to do as a way forward. And we really radically dissented from that view, and that's been the basis of our rather long-term friendship and indeed the book.
So in a way, the purpose here was let us sit down and reason together, basically, about some of the important issues confronting U.S. Was it hard to do? How did you actually write the book? I mean, the process.
We wrote it chapter by chapter and then merged them, but we agreed not to say who wrote which chapter. Mm-hmm. It is a collaborative effort.
But whatever one person wrote, then the other would critique it, and then out of that would come a common new sense of what you wanted to achieve.
The great thing about it is there are literally times when I can't remember who wrote what, because mm-hmm. one of us took the lead, and then the other one would go over it in great detail, and then we'd fuse those two things, have another discussion, and then write again. Mm-hmm. And so it's been gone over to the point that I'm not always certain who wrote what, and that's the real point of the book, to speak with a common voice. Mm-hmm. What was a key challenge, but I really think worked out. And in the beginning, I think we were both healthily skeptical, but I think in the end it got there. And that's really, I think, one of the great successes of the book.
Implicit in the book and your thesis, which we will go into shortly, is a view of the failure of the foreign policy debate in Washington. Talk a little about that. What's wrong? Are the issues being discussed? If not, why not?
Well, I think, unfortunately, this is an establishment. It has two-party wings, and the personal disagreements and dislike between them is very strong. But on a great range of foreign policy issues, if you look at what people at the Carnegie Endowment, where I used to be, are saying from the liberal wing of the establishment, and what many people in the so-called conservative establishment are saying, on a range of key foreign policy issues, not necessarily domestic issues, on these, by the way, John and I would disagree pretty strongly. Mm-hmm. But on foreign policy issues, from Israel-Palestine, through Iran, through relations with Russia, NATO enlargement, North Korea, relations with China,
democratization.
Democratization. And as John said, the last person who I heard say that America is so powerful that in fact it can do whatever it likes in the world if it really puts its mind to it was actually a leading Democrat mm-hmm. intellectual, not a Republican. Mm-hmm. So there is this sameness of the two wings of the establishment, which comes out of the fact, of course, that they do reflect the same underlying American Cold War structures, mm-hmm. which have come out of the Cold War basically unreformed. Democrats and Republicans are both part of that.
And why do you think that happened? Before we get into some of the elements of what you're proposing, is it what Schumpeter would call an atavism? You know, that the elites didn't fade into the background, but just tried to retool some of the old ideas that may have worked in this earlier period?
I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, in Anatole's field, you know, Anatole comes out of a great knowledge of Russia, and being a Soviet scholar was where the action was in the Cold War. Now every Soviet scholar wants to be an energy scholar. They don't go away. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They merely try to adapt, but in adapting, they're not learning. Mm-hmm. They're not changing their knowledge base. They're just trying to adapt because they know they have to say something different, much as I'm a Europeanist by background, which is less sexy now than being about India or China, so we merely adopt to talk about trade flows between the two. That's fine, and adapting is what part of our jobs are. The problem is when you don't adapt intellectually, you merely adapt bureaucratically to survive. And survival, of course, is the name of the game. And so they survive, but with the same kind of views they had in the Cold War, without any notion of what's happened since 1989. And so you get these curious debates like the end of history, which in retrospect looks hubristic, to put it mildly, that everyone's happy, everyone agrees with us. Well, if you're a Cold Warrior, that makes perfect sense. It's the happily ever after part of the fairy tale. The problem is we don't live in a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. How much is accounted for by America's global position in the world? That at the end of the Cold War, we were left with all of this power. We were number one, and through the 90s, we kept building our military budget to the extent where I think our budget is equal to the, you know, the next 25-plus countries and so on. So is this about our turning inward and not coming up with new solutions because we had no threats out there, no one to balance our power?
I think that is very important. There is this feeling, once again, among Democrats in the Progressive Policy Institute, people around Hillary Clinton, and, of course, a great many Republicans, and especially the neocons, that we don't need to compromise with other countries. The way that we get other countries on our side is by talking at them to get them to support us. Not that we have to make concessions to them. Because in the end, there is this belief that even after Iraq, and now the impasse over North Korea, over Iran, there is still this instinctive, almost subconscious belief that after the end of the Cold War, America is so powerful that in the end it can do whatever it likes. This by now seems to me obviously totally irrational, but it's still very much there.
Mm-hmm. In your book, in the setup for your book, you do a very interesting comparative study of American policy in the Cold War, the development of the containment policy. And you again and again are comparing it with what became the Bush policy after 9/11. A very kind of interesting comparison that points out parallels and similarities. And I want to play with that a little before we actually get into your ideas about ethical realism. What was the distinguishing feature of the response to the emerging Soviet threat at the end of World War II?
I mean, I think the key point, there are a couple, but one is utopians on both the left and the right, who have now formed this new, somewhat unholy alliance that we've been talking about.
You mean for today?
For today, we're marginalized politically in the period under Truman and Eisenhower. And we really see Truman and Eisenhower, the political aspects of what they did are really looked at less than some of the other things. And we saw that as vital, meaning Henry Wallace and the left wing of the Democratic Party say Stalin can be appeased. That's a utopian view in our view. Truman had to see that off. On the other hand, Truman and Eisenhower had to see off the right wing, which said, we can do rollback. We can be unilateralists as well. We just can bomb at Manchuria and the Korean War problem will go away. We're the only power in the world. We can take on world communism all over the world together and at once. Senator Taft had this view. General MacArthur had this view. The fact that Eisenhower saw off Taft while Truman saw off MacArthur meant you had a non-utopian center holding in both parties that understood there were limits to American power. However great American power was then, there were real limits to it, that we needed allies not because we loved or hated them, because it's the way you do business in the world, that America, if it was going to survive as the greatest power in the world, had to acknowledge it couldn't do everything and had to draw clear lines everywhere. So if Wallace says no competition, with the Soviets. And if MacArthur says military confrontation, this consensus built around a notion of political competition with the Soviets, that economics, that soft power mattered every bit as much as military power, that if we drew clear lines around the world, in the end, our system, with all of its attributes, would outlast the Soviet system. And it's the remarkable political success of this point of view. And remember, up through Reagan, and we try to reclaim Reagan, you know, George Kennan would have hardly agreed with what Reagan did in his second term. Hardly agreed. This success led to a political agreement that was based on non-utopian goals. The danger today, as we write, is that there's almost an Alice in Wonderland aspect to this, that these utopians who've been wrong for 60 years, and as we write in the book, would you trust anyone with your investments if they're wrong for 60 years, they are now dominating. They are now coming together. And the book is a manifesto for the rest of us who don't hold that view, who agree more with Truman and Eisenhower, to get together, band together, and see that this new utopian consensus doesn't dominate American politics.
You seem to be suggesting that what Truman and Eisenhower succeeded in doing reflected a kind of subtle understanding of both domestic and international politics. Is that a fair rendering of what you're saying? And it seems to be very important given the current situation where we have arrived at the consequences of what we've done by invading Iraq.
Yes, I mean, critical to their success was the fact that Truman saw off General MacArthur and his plans basically for a preventive war against the Soviet Union and China. And Eisenhower then saw off the preventive war school and the rollback school at the beginning of his administration. In both cases, this took great political skill, but also great moral courage. And this is something which the Bush administration, but also we fear to a great extent, the Democratic leadership today has failed to show. They have failed to make hard choices about American policy today. They failed to see off the extremists in their own ranks on a number of key issues. They've also failed, by the way, though here the blame is much more on Bush, since he was, of course, the president. They failed to do what Truman did, which is radically reshape the American government and security institutions to face a new kind of threat, which Truman did with the National Security Act of 1947. Nothing like that has happened. What we get instead is this bureaucratic nightmare of the Homeland Security Agency, together with other institutions which remain wholly unreformed, basically, from the days of the Cold War.
Some of our audience might be younger and not know what you're talking about when you talk about rollback. And I think it really struck me how notions of preemption, the dominant themes in the Bush administration, really recall the kind of illusions and delusions of that earlier right-wing agenda. Could you talk a little about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the points that we were talking about earlier is everyone wants to be Truman right now. You know, that President Bush says he's Truman. Peter Beinart and the liberal hawks say they're Truman. The reason they want to be Truman was that he was politically successful. Nobody wants to be General MacArthur because it didn't work. But if you look at actually the key fact that we write in our second chapter about preventive war, the problem is the liberal hawks sound more like General MacArthur, who they'd loathe, they think. But they sound far more like General MacArthur than Harry Truman or Dwight Eisenhower, meaning that Iraq, which was a preventive war, Iraq was not about to be attacked. And there's a key difference that everyone keeps saying, preemptive and preventive. I know they both start with a P. I know they sound the same. They're entirely different. Nobody's questioning the notion, like Israel in 67, if you're about to be attacked, you can strike the Egyptian Air Force the day before they attack you. Surely that was not the case in Iraq. We were not about to be attacked the next day. This is precisely what General MacArthur said we should do with both the Soviet Union and with China. They're involved in a local offensive. Well, let's strike Beijing without warning. Let's just take it out. This is precisely what James Burnham and some of the apologists for MacArthur in the 50s were talking about. And this is exactly the view that the liberal hawks and President Bush have. So even though they say that they're with Truman, if you follow the philosophy behind what they're saying, they're far more with the losers of history than with the winners. And I think that's a vital difference, that we have to be careful historically not to have co-opted realities. And one of the things that we've had most arguments about is not the policy in the book of what we're saying. It struck us that people have been arguing about the history, because everyone wants to be Truman. There isn't a meeting that goes by that we don't talk about Truman, which has surprised me greatly. Yeah. But in a way, it's about the symbol of victory. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very careful to remind people that these guys are on the ash heap of history, and there's a reason for it, not just now, but for the past 60 years.
Mm-hmm. And we also, if I could add, we very much wanted to revive the memory of Eisenhower for the Republican Party, because it's true that everyone in the Democratic Party now wants to be Truman, but one's heard so little of Eisenhower in the Republican Party, and Eisenhower would have detested most of what the Bush administration has done. I mean, on every single thing, practically, he would have rejected this as insane.
When you look at this period, you do a nice history, which allows us to compare what happened then to what happened now. And here's some items you mentioned: that the conflict must be kept within bounds. This was an insight that drove our containment policy. So we had the doctrine of limited war, the ability to set priorities. You can't have everything. You have to make choices, and so on. Now, what I want to ask you is, was this a consequence primarily, you think, of the leadership then as it compared to the leadership now? Or was it a consequence of the threat of nuclear war that hung over the world after the explosion in Hiroshima?
I think it was both. That the fact that America did not feel all powerful then was very important. America was, of course, extremely powerful, but faced with a Red Army, which had, after all, defeated the Nazis, faced with the Soviet Union with the nuclear bomb, it increased fear, but it also tempered arrogance. So I think that was one thing. But I would also say, and this is why, you know, we emphasize Truman and Eisenhower, and Truman's team as well very much, that the quality of leadership was much higher. There was just a much greater degree of responsibility, of knowledge of the outside world, and a much greater willingness precisely to take morally tough decisions and to make hard choices. That, I think, is one of the key failings of both party leaderships and all the intellectuals in think tanks who depend on them, who want jobs in 2009. They will not sit down and make a hard, very unpopular decision to give up certain American aims for the sake of other aims, to compromise with Russia on certain things, to get Russia on our side in others. Because, of course, any compromise you make, you will be attacked within America. You will be attacked by people in Congress, by various lobbies. But frankly, if you're not prepared to make these choices, you shouldn't be in a leadership position.
Yeah, I mean, just quickly to add, I think that's right. Eisenhower, of course, I'm glad Anatole mentioned that, is really the forgotten guy in all this. Without Eisenhower agreeing basically to Truman's doctrine, and of course they hated each other. It wasn't a personal affinity. Truman felt Eisenhower had betrayed General Marshall, his idol, over the attacks from McCarthy and the fact that he never asked his opinion as an ex-president, which, you know, he rightly was, you know, as McCullough said, he wouldn't talk about Eisenhower without resorting to profanity after he was an ex-president. But they agreed on the basic philosophical principles of what to do. From Eisenhower's point of view, of course, he had been through his management of the war. The reason Eisenhower was given command in Europe, ultimately, was Franklin Roosevelt rightly said, "You are the best alliance general." Patton is far more brilliant tactically, but we don't need that. We need someone to manage an alliance. That was what Ike had always done. And Ike knew that sometimes you had to give way to the British, as over Arnhem, for instance, a terrible idea. But Ike didn't care, because ultimately keeping the British and Field Marshal Montgomery along with them was more important than any specific area. He'd been making trade-offs his entire adult life in command, and so when he comes to power, that's there. The other point is he'd been signing death notices his adult life. There's nothing that keeps you honest but seeing that these are real people. The one thing Truman and Eisenhower had in common that we mentioned was that they didn't like America in some abstract way. They liked Americans. And they knew that these were real people with families and dreams and hopes, and that to spend them wantonly was the ultimate moral failure. And that, in and of itself, leads you to a policy of limits, of humility, of some of the things we talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm. You have an image which I think for our audience is a very good one, comparing the Truman-Eisenhower leadership with that of the present period. And you say those presidents, Truman and Eisenhower, adopted a James Stewart strategy. They faced down the enemies in front of them, preferably without even having to draw a gun. On the other hand, the Bush administration has been the Charlie Chaplin of the international scene. They took a wild swing, hit the wrong man, and fell over their own feet. So with this background, you basically, the problem before you was to, well, how do we to come up with a manuscript, a book, that will shake up people and point out some of the things that we can draw on in our own history to help us understand what's going on. So the idea here is to come up something that links philosophy with politics, with strategy to then talk about contemporary problems. And one key component here is the title of the book, Ethical Realism. You're arguing for a philosophy for dealing with the world that reflects things in our tradition and so on. So let's talk a little about what is ethical realism.
Well, ethical realism is derived from the philosophy of three thinkers who we take as our principal inspirations: Reinhold Niebuhr, the great Protestant theologian, but also the great foreign policy thinker; George Kennan, the architect of the containment doctrine, who later, of course, became a very strong critic of what he saw as excessively militarized American strategies during the Cold War; and Hans Morgenthau, German-Jewish refugee from the Nazis, who became, in many ways, the intellectual father of the realist school. What ethical realism tries to do is two things. The first is it tries to produce a strategy which is conditioned by ethical considerations, both in what it wants to do, but also in things that it refuses to do, like sanctioning torture, for example, while at the same time, unlike we feel, too many people who present themselves as ethical in foreign policy today, actually having a strategy that will work in the real world. The other thing we try to do through ethical realism is produce an approach which will, if you like, bring together the two halves of the American soul. Because we've seen again and again through modern history that most American citizens, quite rightly, expect that the policy of their government will serve the interests of the American people and the security of the American people. In that sense, they're realists. They're not prepared to sacrifice either of these things on a large scale for ethical goals elsewhere in the world. Equally, we've seen again and again that a majority of Americans really distrust and dislike a policy of pure realism, classical realpolitik as espoused by Henry Kissinger, for example. They expect American policy to be morally conditioned, to some extent at least, both in what it aims to do, to create, but also in what it actually does. So what we hope through this philosophy, or the revival of this philosophy, is to try to answer both of these problems in American foreign policy formulation.
And help our audience understand what the tenets that ethical realism offers, tenets, principles, and leading to virtues, I guess you would say, in how we approach the world.
Well, we try to distill, obviously, from this great amount of thinking, really understandable tenets that we could, you know, hang our hat on. And a number of these, you know, we can briefly mention. Study is one of them. And just to give you an idea, Daniel Ellsberg, during the Vietnam War, rightly said that the Kennedy administration, for all its intellectual brilliance, none of the major protagonists could have passed an intro class on Vietnamese history, culture, sociology, ethnology, and that is morally a suspect position to be in. Likewise, Paul Bremer, as was mentioned in the New York Review of Books, and his senior staff, one person had a master's degree in anything relating to Middle East studies. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go into a country and radically alter it, you have to study what that country is about, its history, its culture, its local customs. And if you can't do that, you're bound to fail. And more importantly, morally, you have put yourself in a position that is suspect. And that is something that everyone would understand. Secondly, and in line with this, is humility. Mm-hmm. Even if you have this notion of being able to study everything, you will never know enough to entirely understand what you're doing. The information may be flawed, you may be flawed, the timing may be flawed. If any of these factors are true, it leads to a caution. It leads to a sense of limits. It's not do nothing, but it's do things while being aware that this is the reality. Likewise, this leads to a hierarchy of interests, as Anatole was talking about, that you can't do everything. It isn't enough to make a laundry list, that these tough trade-offs are indeed part of what the world's about. You simply aren't powerful enough or knowledgeable enough to make this work. Prudence is a third virtue that comes out of this, that given this notion that we've brought forward, a prudential view, that there are consequences to your actions. And as in Iraq, if you go in without a plan to deal with the counterinsurgency, without a plan to talk to Sistani, without a plan to talk to the Sunnis, without a plan to safeguard nuclear materials, without a plan for post-war reconstruction, you are not looking at things that are obvious, that the CIA warned them about, that the State Department warned them about, that frankly the Heritage plan for what to do in post-war Iraq warned them about, mm-hmm. that you are violating prudential principles that are fundamental. Responsibility flows out of this, that the key is to have an ethic of consequence and not an ethic of conviction. It isn't enough, as we've said, to say, well, I meant well. Mm-hmm. Everyone means well. The reality is that you have to think about what the consequences are of your actions. For instance, throwing away the lives of servicemen by not doing these things is a morally untenable point. And then our last principle is patriotism. And we think, A, this is important because it has to connect to the American people for all the political reasons we've said. B, it's moral because, like Truman and Eisenhower, I actually like the American people. The reason I'm writing this book is not because we're anti-American, but rather because we love America and are incredibly upset with what's going on. But another key point that's brought up by Niebuhr, among others, is that other people have patriotism too. Mm-hmm. And to assume that the Iranians are going to give up all their principles and support a pro-American position is living in fantasy land. No government in the rest of the world, be it democratic or otherwise, could survive if that were the reality. Meaning, as Atticus Finch said to his daughter Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, to understand a person you have to walk a mile in his shoes. Mm-hmm. And when you add all this together, you get a very different kind of foreign policy coming from this very different philosophy.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I want to go back to what we were talking about before. How did this get lost? These virtues. In other words, is it a matter of timing of where we stood in the world after the end of the Cold War? Is it, as we were talking earlier, the atavism of these groups? I mean, it's one is struck by, wouldn't you expect all these things that you're describing to already be there, because they were there before and they're very American.
Mm. Well, I think two things happened, which were a very, very terrible combination. One was something which in itself was, of course, wonderful, which was American victory in the Cold War. But it did produce this mood of triumphalism, that America is all-powerful, can do anything. And then came 9/11, which made America, as has often been said, seem on the one hand still all-powerful, but at the same time uniquely vulnerable for the first time in its history. That is a disastrous combination, when on the one hand you think you have the power to do anything, but on the other hand you feel very frightened and at risk. So I think those two things together, each of them was seized upon by the neoconservatives in particular, with, it must be said, political brilliance, the way that they seized those two moments and used them as vehicles for their agenda. But the third thing, of course, which was tremendously strengthened by victory in the Cold War as well, and the collapse of the communist model, was American democratic messianism, the belief that America can spread its system to the rest of the world successfully, even if apparently countries don't want it or their elites and governments oppose it, and even if necessary by force of arms. And this is something which is so apparent in the leadership of the Democratic Party as well as the Republicans. And it is, the thing is, it worked in Eastern Europe, but it worked in Eastern Europe for a whole set of very specific reasons, one of them being the European Union, of course, which really did the heavy lifting there, which you cannot replicate in the Middle East, for example. And people have forgotten that. They've forgotten what was unique about Eastern Europe after the end of the Cold War, and they think that somehow Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan resembles Poland from that point of view, and it quite obviously doesn't.
Yeah. Now, it's this one-size-fits-all approach, that there's no difference, really, between Poland and Iraq. And, I mean, something that we said along the way, you know, Iraq isn't a nation. It's three Ottoman Empire provinces put together by the British for imperial convenience, which has never been stable through the supposedly golden Hashemite period where there were 20 coups in 20 years. It's never been stable. And to assume that somehow its history and Poland's are either worth ignoring or that they're the same, and it has to be one of the two, leads to disastrous policy outputs. It's a laziness that goes back to the view of communism that are the people we like philosophically so hated is replicated again. The other key link between the liberal hawks and the neocons and today is this one-size-fits-all, that there are no differences between Persian nationalism, Shiism, Sunni radicalism, Wahhabism, Alawis in Syria. They're all the same. People who want a caliphate and people are socialists, they're all the same. And it's this lumping things together, which is exactly what the preventive war types like James Burnham did wrong. They say Chinese communism will always be like Soviet communism, which will always be like Yugoslav communism. And this was patently untrue then and patently untrue now, and is another example of these liberal hawks who'd be horrified agreeing with James Burnham, who they'd laugh at cocktail parties, but on the other hand, they espouse his views. The world is simply more complicated than that, and we have to remember that.
So it seems talking here to two historians that it's really we're dealing with the consequences of our own history, both its success, but it's also its long-term history. I mean, I think a long time ago it was Louis Hart who said, you know, we did not have a revolution. We're not going to understand the world, you know, when we go out to fight the communists, and he's writing this in 1950. Yeah. So these are continuing themes, actually.
No, and that's one of the key things that I think we did in trying to resurrect ethical realism. See, it isn't just ethical realism that's been around a long time. It's this utopian strain that's been around since James Burnham. And indeed, go back to Thomas Paine. Our soldiers are freezing to death at Valley Forge, and he's writing, "Together we can begin the world over again." This is a battle that's gone on. The difference is the virulence with which the neoconservatives have attacked this, the military aspects of it, and the fact that this time the liberal hawks and the neoconservatives are bluntly winning. After Iraq, that is an astounding thing to say, but the reality is without books like this, which we see as a manifesto to everyone who believes in a sober, realistic, sensible, ethical policy, that they can indeed still emerge triumphant in the place that it matters, Washington, where these power decisions are made. And when you say this to a European, I work in Berlin, they laugh at you. They can't believe that I'm being remotely serious. But the reality is that I am. And if we don't solve things, the great thing about America is it has a corrective system. The great thing about it is that, but people who don't know what's going on can't possibly make that decision. And what we wanted to offer them was an alternate view of both history, of philosophy, but how to wed them together and what we should do from here.
I want to quote you again. You're faulting the Democrats at one point, and you say, but it's a more general point that I think needs to be made. You're criticizing U.S. democratic idealism for the wholly unrealistic time frame it sets for the development of stable democracy, for its indifference for the social, economic, and cultural changes necessary to underpin democracy, and for its bizarre belief that the democracy elsewhere in the world necessarily equals support for American foreign policy.
Well, it's something that's bewildered me since I first came to America. The fact that, after all, America has lived, the United States has lived throughout its history, next to Latin America. What has the history of Latin America been? It's been a history of repeated attempts to create, well, first just constitutional systems, and then later democratic systems, which have repeatedly failed, because the real foundations for a successful democracy, in terms of institution building, in terms of changes in political culture, in terms of economic distribution, not just economic growth, but equitable development, in terms of land reform, were not laid. Now, perhaps let's hope that this is happening now. But today, once again, we see regression in parts of Latin America. What we also see, of course, is that very popular movements, democratic movements there with mass support, are at the same time often bitterly anti-American. And yet, with all this experience of America's own neighborhood behind them, people go out to the Muslim world, for example. And they seriously think that through democracy, you can get Iranians to support American policies, which the great majority of Iranians see as anti-Iranian. That there is something really quite surreal about this, almost lunatic.
I mean, one of the key things we say in the book in line with this is that neoconservatives talk about democracy, but they don't like it being practiced very much. Because the practice of democracy, don't even make it the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Now, Chancellor Schroeder didn't make the German people support by 80% be against the war. The government in Turkey, merely followed by having a free vote in their parliament, were following the 90% of the population against the war. Chirac didn't evilly brainwash the French. Mm-hmm. That you can be democratic and not come up with pro-American outcomes. Look at the Middle East. Say that we're wrong. Say you can add water and get George Washington. We're absolutely wrong. History doesn't matter. Culture doesn't matter. What would we have in the Middle East? The Muslim Brotherhood would be running Egypt. A mixture of generals, people around AQ Khan and bin Laden supporters would be running Pakistan. The King Mohammed of Morocco would be dead, the friend of America. King Abdullah of Jordan, friend of America, would be dead. We'd live in a really dastardly, awful kind of place. Mm-hmm. And is that really in the interest of anybody? If you leave the building blocks out that Anatole talks about, you will get the Hamas election. You will get these outcomes. And for the Bush people to be bewildered, as they have been by this, shows their philosophical background. This is not a group of people who just were incompetent. That's too easy. This is a group of people who had a philosophy that has been found dreadfully wanting. And it's the building blocks of democracy, which may take generations, may take centuries to develop, that really matter. An election is the end result, not the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And you point out that in our present circumstances, these kind of blinders lead to a total misunderstanding of who the adversary is, a confusion of states with internal developments and the sources of terrorism, which then affects the kind of choices about policy, which then turn out to be wrong, and seem to say that all these problems can be solved with military solutions, or rather democracy with guns, basically at the tip of a bayonet.
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, by simplifying these approaches, I mean, President Bush this morning, he had a press conference, said something that was right now, that the war on terror now, one of the fronts is in Iraq. Although that's true, it totally doesn't look at why that's true. To equate Saddam Hussein, Ba'athist, pan-Arab, pan-socialist, pan-secularist, with bin Laden, who's trying to establish a caliphate, wouldn't make sense to anybody. But by getting it wrong, by failing so abysmally to see Iraq as these Ottoman provinces that we've talked about, he's actually created a countervailing movement. Does anyone seriously think that Al-Qaeda have not benefited by American disasters in the Middle East, be it the position in Lebanon, be it Iraq, be it Iran, where they can point, the Crusader imperialists invaded Afghanistan, they've now invaded Iraq, they failed, they're weak, come support us. The ultimate goal isn't the destruction of Al-Qaeda as a structure, it's the stop of radical Islam. And as Rumsfeld, in one of his few moments that I agreed with him, said, are we really winning the war if five guys walk out of a madras for everyone we kill or capture? No, we're not winning hearts and minds, and the problem is worse than we found it. By substituting democracy promotion for fighting Al-Qaeda, where we did have a support of most of the great powers in the world, China, Russia, remember Afghanistan, pretty much everybody came along. Colin Powell was very skillful, but there was the basis for that interest-based deal. By substituting democracy promotion at the tip of a gun, as you say, we've all that goodwill is squandered, and worse, the goodwill from the Cold War has been squandered. Britain, our greatest ally, now thinks we're the fourth most dangerous country in the world. And if we need them to do something military, their military is even more overstretched than our own. There's simply nothing in the bank, either in terms of goodwill or wherewithal, and that's something that we're going to be paying for the decades to come.
Let me show your book again, and then I want you to talk ethical realism, and I want to talk now about the other piece of your work, which is your notion of a great capitalist peace, because this is in a way your long-term vision. So talk a little about that. What do you see that as being, and why it would be conducive to developing a more rational set of policies?
We think that all the major states of the world now, including potentially at least Iran, have or could have a major stake in the stability of the international economy, the international trading system, the international investment system. Now, that doesn't preclude, of course, serious disagreements and problems, as we've seen with China, with the Doha round, and so forth. But nonetheless, if you look at the Russian elites today, I mean, Putin's elites as well, the generals, the security people who he has put in to run these great Russian corporations, they have a profound, not just national stake, but now personal, financial stake in international peace, international stability, markets for their oil, their gas, their minerals. It is vastly less likely now than obviously in communist days that they will do anything that will seriously disturb that. Now, that doesn't mean that we can push them around where what they see as their really vital interests are concerned. Then they will have to resist. Mm-hmm. But they're not looking for serious trouble. That's obviously true of the Chinese as well. The Chinese, a critical reason why the Chinese have been pursuing such a cautious, pragmatic line in recent years is that they think the international capitalist system is working for them. But not just that. The fact that China and America are so intertwined economically has had a tremendous effect in limiting the possibility of serious conflict between them. Now, I'm not saying that that relationship, for the sake of American interests, may not have to be seriously adjusted, but we should under no circumstances tear it up. And what we would like to do is to try to extend that kind of thing to new countries. We think, for example, that opposing a gas pipeline from Iran through Pakistan to India is really stupid, because by creating that, we give Iran and Pakistan a deep stake in regional stability. Mm-hmm. We give Pakistan a deep stake in peace and cooperation with India. We give Iran a deep stake in the economics of the region as a whole. Mm-hmm. And we discourage any of those actors from doing something radical that will seriously disrupt regional and international economic stability.
Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is that rather than, as the liberal hawks or the neocons would say, we're going to tell people what to do, what we want to do is change the calculations of their leadership based on their interests, which coincide with ours. It's an entirely different kind of conversation. As Anatole said, another example would be China. Rather than talk about whether China is going to be a great power, that horse has left the stable. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a great power. Rather than assume we can stop it being a great power, which is crazy, no one ever says how we're going to stop it being a great power, let's talk about whether we can help the Chinese leadership through a series of carrots, largely economic in nature, largely through them doing better and better, creating new hundreds of millions of new people in their middle class, whether through those carrots and the stick of us having good bilateral relationships with India, with Pakistan, with the ASEAN countries, Australia, South Korea, and Japan, whether we can make them make rational choices, which are to remain within the system that they're doing very well. The historical example we use is the British and the French. The French didn't love the British after Waterloo, to put it mildly. But what they did see over that 100 years was that they did extremely well in a British-dominated system where they became richer, their people had more choices, France remained a great power, was treated seriously by the British to the point that when the Great War broke out, they were allies after that period of time. That isn't a one-time thing. That's 100 years worth of history. We see history as moving slowly, glacially, that these things take generations to work out, but we do have the time if we bother not to look at the things that are so wrong. One of the things you can link both liberal hawks and indeed neocons to is their impatience with history, their utopian impatience with history. We want to find out what the motive forces are here, work with the currents of history, which is an old realist Burkean notion, work with the currents of history and change people's ideas slowly over time at the edges, but make it so obvious that Hu Jintao understands that he wants to work within the system. And again, look at China and where it's come from, say, 1967 to now. Ethical realists would say it's moving in the right direction. We have to continue that process over time. There will be setbacks. There will be competitive problems, as Anatole rightly says. But as long as things generally move in that direction, we will find a whole range of issues, from capitalism through terrorism, where the Chinese leadership also don't want terrorism in their restive provinces, or indeed in Beijing, where we can work together in a long-term way and have, as Richelieu said, a community of reason, where we can all talk about these things in a very different way. That's our long-term vision.
What I hear you saying is that by going back to the ethical realism, the leadership, the establishment, might be empowered to transcend what William Pfaff, I remember at the end of the Cold War, called this solipsism of the U.S. And I guess I see two problems. I'm not a policy wonk in Washington, but one is, as part of your discussion of the Great Capitalist Peace, you talk about this notion of the metaphor of the United States as a city on the hill, and the idea always was that we would be emulated by others, that they would see what we had done with laws and the markets and so on, and choose to follow in that path, which is kind of central to your notion of the Great Capitalist Peace. Well, obviously, that has not come to be our ongoing philosophy, which is, namely, we do it at the point of the gun. So that strikes me as one element that presents a problem, you know, getting over this myopia. But the other element strikes me is the factionalism, the partisanship within Washington, so that there is, you put a rational proposal on the table with a philosophy, with a sense of the politics, and it somehow gets distorted, basically, in the cacophony of voices, so that there aren't the structures of authority and the institutions to filter, so that you come out with an outcome. Talk a little about that, because you're both in Washington, you're both frustrated. So how do you see this manifesto working its way through the system and overcoming these two problems? The city on the hill becoming the militarized city on the hill, and the problem of factions, partisanship, and so on.
I mean, to me, I think that's a key point. And we debated Lawrence Kaplan, and one of the things he said that was telling, and I give him credit for coming, was he was very confused. He wanted us to be both a city on the hill and the sheriff of the world. The minute you believe in both, there are going to be contradictions. Mm-hmm. There have to be. Mm-hmm. The minute you engage in, say, guerrilla wars, as we write in the book, there are going to be crimes that have come out of every guerrilla war through overreaction. That's inherent in fighting a guerrilla war. And if you're not prepared to explain beforehand to the American people, there will be these crimes. We're going to have to deal with them in a forthright way, punish the people who did it. We still think it's worth doing for these reasons. Mm-hmm. If you're not prepared to do that, you're abdicating moral courage. We both supported the war in Afghanistan. We were both against, ultimately, the war in Iraq, not because one was cleaner or more beautiful than the other. Certainly abuses occurred in both countries, but because, in the end, Afghanistan struck us as proportional, in line with just war theory. We'd been attacked, and to fight back against who really the enemy was, which is the Taliban and, more importantly, Al-Qaeda. In Iraq, we didn't find any of these linkages. But the problem is the philosophical one that you mentioned, that the minute you indulge in that kind of thinking, you will not be the emulated exemplar that John Quincy Adams said, you know, America will not go abroad in search of sea monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher of the freedom of all, but the vindicator of only her own. That is an inherently American ethical realist kind of position that went back to the founding of the country, his father John being a great example of American conservative thinking and small c thinking. That's the problem. If you try to be everything, as Mr. Kaplan is, both of them will fail. You won't be a very good sheriff, and you won't be a very good example on the Hill. We have to make that choice, and what the book calls for is more the exemplar choice. By saying, if you work with us, look at the benefits you get, but also to the rest of the world, our best public diplomacy used to be, look at what we are, what we're about, that our institutions are attractive, and that you may move slowly, piecemeal, not to become Americans. Mm-hmm. Goodness knows that ought not to happen, and will never happen, but adopt some of the more positive aspects of American life, and over time doing that will make it far easier for us to have this Richelieu-like community of reason. Mm-hmm. Your point about factionalism, I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road. I mean, the timing of the book is not coincidental. I mean, we wrote frantically, I think cleanly, but frantically on our weekends to get this book out ahead of the midterms, because we rightly saw, I'd say a year ago, that we thought the Republicans would pay a great price, and now I think that looks very likely. I think the House is a done deal, and the Senate's now up for grabs, and will be a late night. But if that happens, I think you're going to have that moment where people on both sides, but particularly in the Republican Party, look to say, how did we get to this state? How did it come to this, where we've given up what many of us believe are core Republican principles of small government, balanced budgets, individual liberty, and transparency? And where do we go from here? And that's where Eisenhower becomes this wonderful internal dynamic to bring up again. Also, the Democrats, as Anatole has said, have their own civil war going on. Mm-hmm. The timing of this book is not a coincidence. We wanted to get it out before the midterm, but we also want to influence the presidential race, because you talk about filters. We think that alternatives to neoconservatism and liberal hawk thinking will be a really key factor in foreign policy in the new presidential election. And we want to get the book in the hands of anybody mm-hmm. who remotely thinks that this is true. We're very ecumenical. We think this is true in both parties. We want to work with anybody who thinks this, but we want them to read our book and see that there is an alternative, that we don't just have to manage a bad idea better. We have to come up with a new idea, but an inherently older American idea that's now updated.
And also, just to add something, in the background to all this is a lost war.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In fact, I mean, it's beginning to look like possibly, I mean, I hope not, two lost wars, because Afghanistan is going very badly mm-hmm. wrong as well. And on top of that, a whole set of impasses, of policies which have led nowhere with regard to North Korea, to Iran, to Russia and so forth. If that isn't a good moment for a radical rethink of American policy, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the book, and you know, our time is running out, so you essentially draw conclusions about policies vis-a-vis China, Iran, the Muslim world, and I want to recommend to our readers that they read the book, because in the end, your focus on philosophy, your understanding of the politics of all of this and where we are internationally and domestically point to a set of policies. Because, in fact, all of these failures that we talked about in comparing the Cold War with the Bush Doctrine permeate all of our policies toward Russia, China, and so on.
Well, we very much wanted to have a set of specific policy recommendations. We thought it our duty to do so, because it has been a great weakness of a lot of recent books by authors who perhaps I shouldn't name, but they refuse to engage with specific policies. Mm. One reason is, once again, that when you do that, you inevitably make yourself very unpopular mm-hmm. with certain powerful forces here, whether you call for compromise with Russia, whether you call for Israeli-Palestinian peace, whether you call for détente with Iran. So yes, we go around the world and we make a set of recommendations. And what these are shaped around is the idea that America should retain its global leadership. We're not against that. We're in no sense isolationists. But that the way America does this is not by trying to be dominant everywhere, because that's now beyond America's strength, and it will simply, as we've seen, lead to people ganging up against America. No, the way that America does this is by being the only major power to be present everywhere, to have a major stake in East Asia and Europe and the former Soviet Union and the Middle East, and Latin America, of course, and Africa, hopefully, as well. But what it needs to do is to veil its power, if you will, mm-hmm. by working wherever possible through what have been called concerts, regional arrangements of states, which mostly, not completely, but mostly, will serve America's interests in a region. And where you can't set up a concert, then do it through compromise with some regional great power, like Russia in the former Soviet Union. And that's what we recommend for the Middle East. The only way to get out of Iraq without leaving a complete disaster behind is to get all of Iraq's neighbors, and that has to include Iran and Syria, as well as Turkey and Saudi Arabia, into a regional agreement between themselves to contain and police the resulting conflict, with America stepping back and operating as far as possible behind the scenes and not up front. That, we think, will be much more effective, and it will be much less costly for American money and American lives.
I mean, to jump in, I think Iraq is a great example. Today the president was saying, when somebody suggested maybe we should talk to the Iranians and Syrians, to my joy, they suggested that. The president said, no, we have real problems with them, meaning the conversation is over. Well, of course we have real problems with them. Diplomacy is about the business of talking to people you don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And we seem to have forgotten that entirely in our policies in both North Korea and in Iran, and in indeed many places in the rest of the world where we lecture people and then ask for their help. Russia leaps to mind. the point is, as T.E. Lawrence said about the Middle East, that it's their way, their culture, and our time here is short, that the people of the region are going to be there long after American troops have withdrawn, that they have a common interest in Iraq not falling apart entirely, which is quite lucky, that Turkey certainly doesn't want an independent Kurdistan, that Saudi Arabia is terrified of chaos on its border, that frankly, even the countries like Syria, which are very wobbly, remember the Shiite revolution of last year, don't want a massive influx of problems from Iraq, that talking to these countries, that working out common arrangements, just a few broad brushstrokes, you know, we don't have to do the detail, they do, but being involved in those broad brushstrokes takes an entirely different way of thinking, but it's the only way that we will leave Iraq in remotely acceptable shape. And part of ethical realism is about making these very tough choices. But I don't think it should be a tough choice to talk to people we don't agree with. Indeed, I think that's the business of diplomacy. We used to be really good at this under Truman and Eisenhower. Even think about Nixon talking to the Chinese at the height of the Cultural Revolution. Certainly, Mao and Zhou Enlai didn't share our values. But on the other hand, by doing that, it really mitigated many of the failures of the Vietnam War and was entirely the right thing to do. You need to think creatively again about talking to people you don't agree with if we're going to make the world a better place. It's easy to have slogans. It's harder to do the hard business of diplomacy.
One final question requiring a brief answer. What advice would you give to the general public about how they can change things in light of the ideas you're proposing? I'm not asking you to endorse a candidate, but rather, you know, what can the electorate and the citizen out there watching this, what should they do about all of this?
The first thing they need to think about, they need to think about their sons. And in every specific case, they need to look at the case, they need to think, would I want my son or my brother or myself to go and fight in this case? If not, what should we do? And they ought to press this need for choices on their elected representatives. Now that, of course, means at least the educated electorate has to study the world a lot more than it has. But they have to demand from their elected people what ought to be the responsibility of those elected officials anyway, which is to think constantly about the lives and the interests of ordinary Americans. American interests are not the interests of some abstract state. They're not the interests of the policy elites in Washington or the military and security establishment. They are the interests of the collective of ordinary American citizens. And that is what American leaders should think about all the time.
I would just briefly say we have to get beyond the platitudes, and to get beyond them, we have to not say, let the slogans go by without challenging them constantly. Don't talk to me about democracy without explaining how. Don't talk to me about freedom without explaining how. Don't talk about any slogan that you hear without asking a tough follow-up question. It's a lack of oversight at the level of public opinion, as well as Congress, as well as the courts, as well as the wonk community, that has led us into this mess. We need better citizens, as our founders knew, and that will lead to more transparency. We need to know what's going on in the world. That's the duty of our government to tell us, but it's also the duty of the citizenry to be informed. All the founders, that was the great but. If you're not informed, there will be a disaster. Get informed, ask tough questions, hold your leadership to account. After all, that's what a republic is about.
On that note, I want to show your book one more time. Encourage everybody to go out and buy it and read it. And thank you, Anatole, and thank you, John.
Pleasure.
For joining us on Conversations with History. And thank you for joining us for this Conversation with History.